This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. Welcome to the morning run on BFM 89.9, the business station.
I'm Melissa. I love that little interjection. What do they call it? A frog in your throat?
A frog in your throat. Very early morning too early for a frog in my throat this morning.
But good morning, Melissa. Good morning, Sharad.
Good morning. That was Ibrahim Sani you just heard there. And we've got a great show lined up for you, along with Julian Ng, who'll be joining us shortly. Let me tell you what's coming up on the show. On The Breakfast Grill today, Sharad, you're going to be speaking to Tan Sri Musa Hassan, Chairman of the Malaysian Community Crime Care Association, or MCCC.
Well, you know, look, honestly, I don't know how many people even know of the MCCC.
That's right.
And would it make a difference? A lot of people weigh in on this issue of crime. I think public sentiment is very acutely attuned to issues around crime. Everybody's got an opinion about it. Everybody's got a story about it. The thing about Tan Sri Musa Hassan is that he was the IGP. And
that's
in fact,
right.
You know, in the noughties, being starting 2000 to 2010, he held very high positions in the police. But it also was a period where we saw a huge spike in crime, especially violent crime in this country. And we also had the Royal Commission, which made so many recommendations, yet which wasn't, in fact, followed up on. And so, you know, I think at the middle of that decade,
yep,
it was already acknowledged in the report. And, you know, it says that, I'm going to read you from a piece here. It says that there was, in fact, a breakdown in public trust and confidence in the police force, which is generally viewed as inefficient, uncaring, unable to prevent or check crime, with infringements of human rights extensive, and PDRM is not seen as being transparent or accountable to the public. This was the Royal Commission's, these are the words of the Royal Commission. So extraordinary, I think, critique of the system. Came out with lots of recommendations. This is one of the centerpieces, I think, of the Abdullah Badawi administration. And what transpired? Well, nothing.
Yeah.
He promised to put all those recommendations into place, and then we had nothing. And I think we have suffered the consequence of a great initiative being not just ignored, I think resisted deeply by the police force. And that's one of the questions I'm going to be putting to Musa Hassan. You know, he was there.
Right.
Was there a revolt in the police force against the Royal Commission and its recommendations, and why?
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic framing. Also, you know, his post-work seems to be more, post-work of IGP, being an IGP, seems to resonate more with the public. So it's amazing for someone that is pro-government when he was IGP and now taking a very odd stance, criticizing the government at every turn. If you look at this, his Twitter user timeline, you could see that he's actually taking, you know, a very critical stance on the government. And I'm trying to understand, he could do a lot more when he was in, in office.
He was in the police force for 41 years, and that's a long time to be part of such an institution.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether he has, what he thinks of it now, whether he has a different view after leaving PDRM, right?
Yeah. So I think, of course, that when you're in uniform, there are certain, you know, codes of conduct. I mean, he probably couldn't criticize the government of the day. I think the real issue for a lot of Malaysians is not so much whether he was, you know, openly critical or not of the government of the day, but whether he conducted himself and his force conducted themselves in a professional manner, meaning they didn't allow themselves to be used as instruments in political rivalries or competition. And I think that's something that's a huge question mark around. In fact, I think in 2012, he did make accusations that senior politicians were trying to or had interfered in police investigations. So he did, in fact, begin very, you know, very early on to note this dimension of the relationship between the police force and the executive.
I'm looking forward to this grill. Don't miss it. After the 8 o'clock news with Tan Sri Musa Hassan, former IGP of Malaysia. Was it 2006 to 2010? He was IGP? There you go.
Absolutely right.
All right, that's 8:05 a.m. And after the Breakfast Grill, we have current affairs. Today, On the show, we explore the ways to combat sexual predators online. Now, the revelation of the case of British paedophile Richard Huckle here in Malaysia has unleashed an outcry for robust and specific national laws to protect children from all forms of sexual violence and abuse. Now, advocates are arguing that a lack of proper regulation will likely cause the perpetrators to re-offend by hiding behind the anonymity of
of the dark web, but yes.
Thank you, of the dark web, because they just can go, they have other avenues to relapse, shall we say.
So, almost a year ago, I had, in my very first Breakfast Grill, I interviewed Nancy Shukri, the Minister of Law,
asking her,
de facto. And by the way, there's a side note to that. She wants people to stop calling her that, de facto Minister of Law. I'm not too sure why, though. But back to the grill, I asked her whether or not the Child Act that we have, the Child Act 2001, was enough for us to protect our young, particularly not just from predators and pedophiles, but also from child marriages. You know, 8-year-old child has been married off to 40-year-old men legally, by the way. So these things are happening in the country, and whether or not it was enough. And of course, the minister at that time did not say that there will be better laws, but saying that the existing laws are there to prevent such things from happening. So I guess it's not just about having laws in place. It's also about the enforcement of it. And it sickens me that a person like Richard Huckle can roam the streets of Kuala Lumpur and rape kids.
Well, she's saying that now the federal government and the Attorney General are in midst of looking into more amendments to legislation governing child rights here. But also the Women, Family and Community Development Ministry are warning parents against posting photos of their children on social media.
Now, this is ridiculous because it means that now I can't do anything online because just because there is a predator out there, now I have to change my behavior?
Overseas, parents are very careful about posting pictures on social media, about taking photos. And I remember when I was studying journalism and I was out on a shoot for a class, and I had to get written consent from strangers that I would blur out the faces of their photos because it was against the law to take a photo of somebody else's child.
Right. I mean, to what extent is this an overreaction? In some sense, you can never, shield your children away from the gaze of a whole range of strangers. You take them out in public. Somebody might look at them and, you know, have all kinds of thoughts that are perhaps criminal in nature.
But the point is, that's it, right?
So what do? Keep them at home?
But no, you can limit the damage, right? You can limit the exposure. You can mitigate the risk.
Well, you know, if you put a photograph of your child on Facebook and somebody looks at it or uses it, whatever, abuses himself looking at it, nobody needs to know. I mean, nobody will know. You won't know, right? Because the way in which the reception of that image is not something that's out there, unless the person then makes a remark of it, and we had previously, remember, I think it was Harris Iskandar's
kids. Yes.
Well, so then the image finds itself on a particular portal. Again, where is the harm? In the sense, how is the harm reaching back to the kid or the parent, right? The parent knows about it, but the kid knows about it. You know, so I'm just thinking, you know, because the world is so mediated, meaning so much of our lives they're out online, images of ourselves, our voices, things we say, and it's captured and owned by other entities and stuff like that. Can we really withdraw ourselves from this? I mean, is there really a going back to a period when you have? And in fact, pedophilia and these kind of practices predate the web.
The social media.
It's not like this is new, you know.
Well, apart from sexual predators online, what about in real life? Bukit Aman has recorded 567 cases of children under the age of 18 who have been missing since early January. This is in the past 6 months, you guys. We're talking about 567 cases in the past 6 months. And of those cases, only 374 have been found. So that's about almost 200 cases still unsolved. That's a lot of kids.
That's a lot
missing.
Of kids.
That's a lot of missing children.
I want to clarify what I'm saying. And I'm not saying there isn't a problem. I just think the situation is so complex today that there are no easy solutions.
But I'm sure there are, I mean, steps that parents take.
Absolutely.
I'm not a parent, but I would be very careful about posting any photos of my niece online.
Well, I think that's the least of your problems. If you look at the case of Huckle, the fact that the children reported certain Huckle's behavior to adults, grandparent, father, and it was completely ignored, right? And that's more problematic, you know, that Asian attitude or maybe a traditional attitude, Asian or otherwise, that children are to be seen and not heard. We don't take the statements or testimony of children equal to adults. All these things. I mean, these are, I think, much more important issues to tackle in the long run than, you know, whether you put a picture up on Facebook or not.
Okay, well, it's now 11 minutes past 6. Let's take a look at some other news that was late-breaking. A 19-year-old labourer was sentenced by the Sessions Court, a total of 1 year in jail for posting insulting comments against the Tengku Mahkota of Johor on his Facebook account. So Muhammad Amirul Azwan had pleaded guilty to 14 counts of posting the insulting comments against TMJ with the intention of hurting the prince's feelings and also that of the royal institution.
Yeah. You're from Johor, as we heard during the Shahul Samad interview. Oh, by the way,
Could I just correct myself? That's a total of 14 years. So because there were 14 counts, just to elaborate, 14 counts of posting insulting comments, the maximum jail time is a year for each count. So he got 14 years. This 19-year-old boy got 14 years.
No, hold on. So are the sentences to run concurrently?
Yeah, the sentences are to run concurrently.
Really, it means that it's only a year.
It's only a year. Yeah.
Okay, I see.
But they just want to reflect it upon the court's record.
Yeah. That it's 14 counts. Yeah. Richard
Huckle, right?
I don't think celebrities or people, public figures, ought to be so thin-skinned, first of all. But this might not be, this is the police taking action, not necessarily a complaint coming from His Royal Highness. But I still think it's extraordinary that the courts thought this way. And I think you look at the chatter on Twitter, you know, lawyers are weighing in. This is really, disproportionate. And I think it's very scary to think that we are moving into a situation where people are being punished for this kind of thing. It's so severely. What do you think that's going to be achieved by this? I asked the judge.
I don't know why they thought this warranted the maximum sentence. I mean, the boy pleaded guilty. So he pleaded guilty to all charges. And according to some lawyers, a guilty plea should allow for some leniency in the sentencing, the fact that he's also quite young and a first-time offender. Sharizan Johan, the constitutional lawyer, he weighed in. He said the state has no business regulating manners. And he was asking
Is it a crime to be badly mannered? I mean, you know, many children would we have to send off to to the gallows for being
19,
badly mannered?
I did many foolish things, and for it's scary to think that I would be jailed for some of the things that I do. You really have to think into consideration, because Sharizan here has some big principal questions here. The state has no business regulating manners. A guilty plea should be allowed for some leniency. There's first time offences. Where's the real harm in the actual offence that was committed? There's also the fact that the maximum jail time is only applicable for some of the offences committed under the MCMC Act. There's so many problems here.
Well, you know, and what will this mean for this boy to have a record and jail time? What will that mean for the future, for his future, right?
You know,
he's a labourer, and do you think he...
You just started off in life, right?
Yeah. Okay.
You know, I do think that... I hope there's an appeal, and I hope there are lawyers out there who will defend him and really test the limits, you know, and take the courts to task for this and maybe make sure that our laws are reasonable rather than, in this case, it seems quite... disproportionate. Mm-hmm. So
let's round off our look at the news this morning. Minister in Prime Minister's Department, Nancy Shukri, she says that she will not participate in any parliamentary vote to support or deny the private members' bill to strengthen the Sharia courts. Now, Nancy Shukri is from Sarawak, and also from the PBB, and they have said Tan Sri Adnan Satim has come out to say that PBB will not back the so-called hooded bill.
Yeah, so she's standing down, essentially. She's abstaining, albeit abstaining in absentia. And the question is, why didn't she vote down the hooded vote altogether? Because, you know, a vote can go three ways. You support a motion, you do not support the motion, i.e. you vote down the motion, or you abstain. Why did she choose to abstain when PBB says that they will not support
it? Well, hypothetically, abstain. It's not been put up for a vote yet.
No, but she's already signaled her intention and the course of action. And I think it's irresponsible. First of all, you know, the Malaysian public pays MPs to deliberate and take decisions.
We'll add on to that, because an MP says that the public does not pay you, but we'll add on to that statement.
Yeah, what? Who's?
So Langkawi
That, okay.
So why don't we just round off this news? So Langkawi MP, Yang Berhormat Nawawi Ahmad, has said yesterday that public funds do not belong to the people, and therefore the MPs are not paid by the people. And he says that once money has been transferred to another quarter, it is no longer their money.
So essentially he's saying that his salary is not paid for by the public.
Okay, fine. Whatever. It's a quibble, right? The point, the important point is you have a
more
duty.
More than a quibble, Sharad.
Hold on. Before you go for me, let me just say that we're on the same page. Oh, I agree with you. The point is, he has a public duty, or she has a public duty. MPs have a public duty to perform something. What is that?
Yeah.
Making decisions.
Yeah.
Saying, I don't want to make a decision, I don't think is an option for an MP, unless they get sick or they're called away or there are other duties that, you know, of a higher order that take them away from Parliament. We expect them to be in Parliament and make decisions.
Okay, so, you know, to be fair, she has made that decision, i.e. not to support, literally not to support that bill. Now, the question is whether or not that is enough.
Yeah, I mean, she could not support the bill by voting against it, as her party, you know, stand is, or she could abstain if her position is this, that she is unsure. She must tell us, why does she not want to vote? I mean, is it that she disagrees with the party stand? Is she for hooded but can't do it because she's a member of a party that's already taken a public position on it? I would want to know my MP, you know, stand is based on.
Well, we spoke to P. Gunasekaran, former editor of Kini Biz, longtime journalist, on Pressing Matters earlier this week. And he said that, you know, he expects, should this come to a debate and tabling in Parliament, he expects a lot of MPs to remain silent or be absent because perhaps they feel conflicted, you know, to go on public record and say whether they agree or not.
Yeah, that's the thing. You should not feel conflicted, because I think everyone should have a conscience, and I think MPs of all must have the biggest conscience of them all. And in my breakfast grill with Tan Sri Samat Said, I asked him, do you think that, you know, as the backbencher bloc, do you guys vote on conscience? And he said, no, we never vote on our conscience.
Well, they're not allowed to, right?
You're not allowed to. You're not allowed to have a conscience as an MP?
No, well, that's not... Oh, it's not even about a conscience. It's about having a political position.
Yeah. Okay,
and, you know, and weighing the arguments for and against this particular bill, which and its consequences for the Federation.
Yeah.
I mean, if she can't make a decision on this, I mean, that's extraordinary lapse of responsibility.
Yes, and it's not just her that might have this lapse of responsibility. There are ministers from PBB in the cabinet. This includes Douglas Ugah Embas, the Minister of Commodity. We have Rohani, the Minister of Women. We have Fadilah Yusof, the Minister of Works, as well as Wan Junaidi, former Deputy Speaker and also Minister of Environment. These individuals, they have to at least declare what they are going to do about this vote, right? Are they going to fall in tandem with Tan Sri Adnan Satim's call, i.e. not to support the bill, or they have to vote down the bill? Either or, we need to know their position. And there's many others inside the cabinet deputy ministers are not in the cabinet per se, but they represent the government. This includes James Dawos Mamit, the Deputy Minister of Technology, Alexander Ninta, the Deputy Minister of Urban Affairs. So there's plenty of PBB representation in the cabinet and deputy ministers. What is their stance? If they actually stand for something that would speak volumes in Najib's administration.
Okay, so maybe Nancy Shukri coming out to say this is what she plans to do might trigger some other MPs saying this, saying, you know, wanting to come out and declare their position as well. We'll have to
declare the position
or not. You know, I mean,
declaring a position like means taking a position in the House. I mean, you are elected to the House. Saying I'm not going to attend. That, I think, is reprehensible.
Okay, yeah. Well, that maybe there might be public pressure coming out after that statement.
Just to add on, right? I mean, UMNO MPs have already stated that they will support the bill. Past MPs have stated that they will support the bill. Now, we cannot ignore the fact that they might speak for their own constituents. For whatever reasons that, you know, I might personally not agree with, they are speaking up for their constituents. Now, if they are exercising their responsibility in supporting that bill, we need voices to come out and say that they have to reject that bill, because that might reflect on their constituencies. So this is the pure fact of democracy, right? You just because you don't like something doesn't mean that you can't have it.
You can't run away from it.
Yeah. So UMNO MPs have declared it. Past MPs have declared it. I think they're being responsible for their own constituents.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, looking at other news, guys, there's a story from Taiwan where the director of an animal shelter there has reportedly ended her life after she received heavy criticism online for having to put dogs to sleep in her job. So she passed away 5 days ago. She injected herself with euthanasia drugs available at her workplace. And in a suicide note she left behind, she said, "A human life is no different from a dog's. I will die from the same drugs we use to put dogs peacefully to sleep."
You know, this is a very sad story, right? Because as a vet, you're supposed to care for animals. And in her line of work, it's only her that can euthanize animals because she's a vet. And now imagine this. You spend most of your adult life learning or equipping yourself from being a doctor. Now you have to put away animals. And people are criticizing her, by the way, for doing so.
She went on a TV show a few months ago to talk about her job. And she was trying to tell people, you know, adopt, don't buy dogs.
Yeah.
And from that news segment, she received so much online criticism that it pushed her to the brink of depression and over the brink, in fact, decided suicide. Yeah.
Okay. So the question is, there you have this mob mentality out there that has a channel through social media to critique somebody and to put a lot of pressure on them. But, you know, I think the individual has to take responsibility. In this case, the vet herself. You can always switch off social media. You don't have to be on Facebook.
Yeah.
You don't have to be on Twitter. So the question is, was it really just the mobs, the angry mobs that called her the beautiful executioner or whatever it is they used against her? Or was it her own lack of resolve, you know, her inability to explain her position adequately to herself that ultimately led to her suicide?
I think the question of depression is a larger story for this person. We might not be in the position to understand what was going through her mind at that moment in time. But I think the larger responsibility here is on animal shelters. I think that shelters can only do so much. In the end, if you cannot sustain the population within those shelters, what do you do?
Yeah.
Right?
And it seems humane to, in fact, cull the animals.
Yes.
I mean, some people disagree. I've been to my local vet in Section 17. The first time I went there, as I walked out with the vet because she was closing the place, there was an animal that was abandoned. She said she gets this all the time. People
abandoned in front of the vet.
People, you know, middle class people who maybe even purchase an animal, at the end of the animal's life, whatever reason, there's the problem, kidney failure, whatever, don't want to spend money to put the animal down humanely. So they sneak up to the vet. They leave the animal there. And in the hope that the vet will do it, free of charge. And in fact, there's a sign that says, don't do this. Don't abandon your animals at the front door just because, you know, you want to get a... Well, she doesn't go on to say that. She just says, don't abandon the animals.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's extraordinary. And I think there's something about our relationship to animals. I mean, I don't think, dogs are similar to, say, human children. We talked about this over the gorilla thing, mm-hmm. but really.
We also wanted to point out that we have a new video released under our BFM Uncensored channel. You can find this on YouTube or our Facebook page. It's an interview with Tan Sri Sharir Samad. Now, he was on The Breakfast Grill last Friday, but after that, Ibrahim, you also spoke to him for a little chat off off air, on camera.
Yeah, off air, on camera. So I guess it's on air, I suppose. And
sure, why not?
And the question was on the pericalism of Sultanate of Johor and how Johor is a little bit different from the other guys.
Well, in what he goes on to say, of course, is that in fact that's not unusual. It's not unique to the Federation, mm-hmm. Johor's, as he puts it, parochialism. Or it's, some people call it Johor nationalism or this Johor, you know, first attitude.
Bangsa Johor, right?
Yeah, and he points to Kelantan. But it's a nice little clip. Please go to it. You know, if you remember, we did Rafizi Ramli recently and also, you know, the de facto minister of religion and such. So
under BFM Uncensored Facebook page, you can find that, the video there, or on YouTube. 6:41 right now, let's take a look at the Milgram Obedience Experiment. So if a person in a position of authority ordered you to deliver a 400-volt electric shock to another person, would you follow those orders? Now, most people would answer this question with an adamant no, but it turns out that Yale University psychologist Stanley Milgram, he conducted a series of obedience experiments during the 1960s that led to some surprising results. Now, these experiments offer a compelling and disturbing look at the power of authority and obedience.
Well, why is it that 1960s produces one of the weirdest experiments known to man?
Okay, so that's a very good question. You should be on Night School, which is also taking this subject up. So tonight, our Night School, you'll be able to hear a discussion of Milgram's experiment and some of these other work. But what's important is that, you know, the experiments really began the same time that the Eichmann trial was going on in Jerusalem. Eichmann was, because he, you know, top dog in the Nazi government of Germany, and he was being tried for war crime. So it actually happened about the same time. But Milgram himself, you know, a child of, you know, immigrants from Russia and Central Europe, Jewish, was very concerned about what happened over World War II. And okay, in fact, I think much of the Western world was concerned by what happened during World War II. And so the issue was, why did so many people comply with the orders of the Nazi government? Eichmann himself kept saying over and over again, or well, I just followed orders. That a defense? And so, you know, again, for especially high-ranking officers, is following orders enough of a defense? I don't believe it is. Mm-hmm. And what I think the trial in Jerusalem, you know, established is that we all have some moral agency. We must take responsibility. There is a very recent film which came out last year called The Experimenter, which is about Stanley Milgram and the Milgram experiment and some other experiments he did. Fascinating. And I think, you know, it was relevant then.
Of course,
there's
also X-Men First Class, where we saw the experiment and we saw that, you know, the creation of Magneto.
I missed that one. Yeah. But, you know, I hope to catch it, you know, when it comes to television. But, you know, the most important thing is that... Yes, World War II was the occasion for why people were concerned about the issue. They were concerned about liberation, freedom, our fear of freedom. These are titles that were, you know, going around, or titles of books that were being written. I think now it's still an issue. We see so much horror in the world, so much inhumanity, and people often justify it in different ways, either in... They say, well, they're just following orders. It's, you know, they're following the law. They're following God's law. All these things justifies, you know, really behavior, I think, that borders on depravity.
So the Milgram experiment was to show that a presence of someone in authority would elicit some... compliance?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So they found that it's like 65%. So what Milgram did was he thought this experiment, and I could explain more, but you could actually catch Night School tonight for a longer explanation. Because we're allowed that. We have so much more time on Night School. But, you know, the point is that he thought he would find non-compliance in America, and he was going to take this experiment to Berlin, to Germany, and do it there and see maybe there was a difference. But he actually found, against the intuitive, opinions of many of his colleagues, that in fact most Americans wouldn't comply, you know, and people did. And so he was shocked, and he redid the experiment. He tried to, you know, he tried to control the experiment for, you know, race and gender, right, and all these things, and still,
I mean,
he got the same result.
That's surprising to me, because I wondered, I always thought that there was a function of culture, a cultural element to a society's deference to the elders or authority.
So you don't think of American society as being that? Is that
yes,
right?
Well, I don't think Western society in general as being, you know, a society collectively that is obedient to authority or deference. I think the word is deferent to authority.
But let's take Nazi Germany as a prime example. I mean, everybody, of course, they fell in line. But, you know, was it because the Nazis obviously had already started by, you know, disciplining the population, right? So they picked on the Jews, they used them as the punching bag. And then after that, they basically cowed everybody into, they attacked the gypsies, they attacked communists, they attacked homosexuals. Basically, they terrorized their society. So you might say that is the reason. But there was also this, you know, this maybe something hardwired. I think that's a discussion. Are we hardwired to
respect and obey authority?
Are we like a pack of dogs, basically, the hierarchies?
You need an alpha male.
That's exactly.
Wait, not alpha female, also can.
Alpha.
Alpha.
Yeah, because as you can see, Jurassic Park, or Jurassic trailer, they have that alpha. Anyway, there is this big problem with 1960s and the experiments. And I think Harley Harlow, have you heard of them? The Harlow experiment. Harlow was an American psychologist, and he has a maternal separation experiment where they were controversial. They included cultivating infant monkeys in isolation chambers for up to 24 months, from which they emerged intensely disturbed. So these are the kind of experiments that are being done in the US in the 1960s. That have shown that while it may be disturbing, it does come about as very insightful. And this strips away that whole, culture, society, Western society being.
But you're talking about primates here. You're not talking about humans, right? So they weren't separating human children from their mothers,
By law, he can't. But yeah. Essentially, given the chance, I'm pretty sure Mr. Harlow or Dr. Harlow would have probably done
it. Well, I don't know. I mean, the issue is, you know, experiments on other human beings are controversial. People did criticize Milgram for the experiment because it turns on a deception. The person isn't, in fact, being electrocuted. The subject thinks he's not the subject. He thinks that the other person in the room for whom he's, you know, giving these electric shocks is the subject. In fact, he is being observed,
right,
the person administering. And he doesn't administer very much. He just doesn't know it. So people came out of it slightly distressed. They're distressed with themselves. You know, they went back and they told their spouses, I didn't think I was capable of that.
So when you read about the Milgram experiment, what did you think, Sharad? I mean, in terms of, do you think figures in authority know that this is the way the human brain is hardwired and therefore that's why they can get orders obeyed?
Yeah, well, this is the thing. I actually had heard of the Milgram experiment very early on because it's so famous. Mm-hmm. I didn't read the book. And it was only, you know, this week that I watched the documentary. It's a kind of documentary, fictionalized documentary about Milgram that alerted me to the book again. And so, yes, I do think politicians and people in charge of the state, I think there's a psychological warfare department in most states that look at how to manipulate populations.
But I also feel on the other side, people obeying orders or following commands feel like they have less responsibility for their actions because they say, oh, I was just following orders. Someone else told me. It's easy to kind of shirk off that responsibility. And I think that for me was the kind of the thing that I took away from the Milgram experiment.
And that's why it's a bit problematic for us to prosecute or state to prosecute, say, genocide and so on, because they always say that there's always a higher up. It's easy to prosecute.
But it's not a defense.
Yeah.
It's not accepted as a defense. And this is, and I think this is established now. But I'm actually concerned with, say, the actions taken against that young man who, you know, expressed his feelings on social media and now is going to serve a year in jail.
So this is in relation to the Facebook poster who offended the TMJ in Johor.
Yeah, the Tengku Mahathir Johor. And I think it's very, I mean, I'm not saying there's a conspiracy, but I do think there is a very chilling effect. We see that with the use of the Sedition Act against, politicians and activists. And I think all of it creating the atmosphere that primes people for compliance and obedience rather than individual thoughtful action that's proactive and not passive. So, yeah, I think there's a problem.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.